To Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guests are Roxana Robinson and James Fry. First up is Roxana Robinson. Roxana is the author of three novels, Summer Light, This Is My Daughter, and Sweetwater, the biography George O'Keefe, A Life, and three collections of short stories, A Glimpse of Scarlet, Asking for Love, and her most recent book, A Perfect Stranger. Four of these have been named New York Times Notable Books, and she was named a Literary Lion by the New York Public Library. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Harper's, Best American Short Stories, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, The Boston Globe, Vogue, and elsewhere. She has received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the McDowell Colony, and the Guggenheim Foundation. Her work has been widely anthologized, and her books have been purchased in England, Spain, France, Germany, and Holland. Hi, Roxana.
Hi. Nice to be here.
Great to have you. A Perfect Stranger, short stories. Now, when you've written such a variety of things, was short stories your first love, or are short stories one of the things you love?
I've always loved short stories, and in this country there's sort of a convention that holds that writers starting out write short stories and then they graduate to novels. And I certainly started out writing short stories. It seems to be a good form when you're not clear in your own mind exactly what it is you want to say or how you want to go about saying it. But it's also a form that is very responsive to someone who's gone further along the road of writing. It's a very demanding form. It's very austere, really. There isn't much room in it for anything but this particular moment that you're trying to capture. I do love the form, and I did what a lot of writers do. I started out writing short stories, and I wanted to publish a collection, and I was told that I couldn't publish a collection until I'd published a novel, so I wrote a novel. But I've never stopped writing short stories, and I actually love all the writing that I do. I love nonfiction, I love novels, and I love short stories, but the forms are very different, and I like this very much, the short story.
Yeah. Do you find that the form of the essay is similar to the form of the short story? Do you find them similar forms in any way?
Yes. Because, I mean, I don't know how other people write essays, so it might be different for other writers, but when I write an essay and when I write a short story, I'm actually trying to explain something to myself. I choose something that's troubling to me or confusing or puzzling, and I write to try to figure it out. So I explore different ways of approaching it. With a short story, I start out with a moment that I know about in some way. Sometimes it's something that someone has told me about. Sometimes it's something I've experienced myself, or sometimes it's something I've witnessed. And that moment stays with me as something very powerful that I need to deal with somehow. So a short story is begun with what happens at the end of it. And I write towards that moment, trying to make it, when it arrives, as powerful for the reader as it was for me. When I write an essay, I start with some kind of problem, some statement, some puzzling fact, and I write towards some kind of ending. In the essay form, I don't know what the ending will be. It's sort of, how can I work this out? And I end up somewhere that I didn't know about when I began it.
So the short story, then, you have the ending before you begin.
I really do. In fact, what happens is I write towards that moment. Once I get there, something else always happens. But that's the moment that is the genesis of it.
Interesting. Do you also sort of think out the whole piece in your head before you write it? For instance, the stories in A Perfect Stranger, are they formed before they go down? And I guess I'm asking that because my guest last week too, Andrew Vax, he said basically that writing his novels is he's transcribing. He's figured it out, and he's not writing a long plot outline. He's thought about it before he puts a word onto the paper, and it sort of sounds like you're somewhat similar.
It's actually not similar, and it's not at all the way I work in novels. I don't have plots. I don't have outlines in novels. I have a sense of how things will go, but it's really because of the characters, not because of a grand design that I have. And even in the short story, so I know that this moment is going to arrive, but I don't plan it. I write towards that moment and just need to get there. But I don't know how I'm going to get there. I don't know how I'm going to get there when I start.
Sure. You know where you want to go. You just...
Yeah.
I got you. Okay. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is Roxana Robinson, author of A Perfect Stranger and Other Stories, published by Random House. I asked you about essays as well because, years ago, I don't know how many years ago, it's been a few years, I came across a book of essays called Writers on Writing, actually. No relation to this show, and you have an essay in it that I don't recall the full name to, so I'm not going to mangle the title of that essay, but that I have so often read the first part of it to my students because of the wonderful twist where the woman is not the woman that we think she is, who's in the car that you're following. I don't really want to give the whole story away, give the essay away, but maybe I can ask you in terms of that. Now, did you know, had you seen the image, had you seen this car with this guy and this creature driving down the road, the country road, and it sparked the idea for the essay, or how did that happen? It was such a wonderful twist, and I recommend everybody read that essay if you're into essays to really read a master.
The title of it was not my title. It was given it by the New York Times, and it was called If You Write the Story, You're the First to Know How It Ends. I think that's what they
Okay, sure,
it,
which, that's it.
Which I guess is, yeah, it's true. It wasn't my title, but that it actually happened to me. I was driving. I did live on a dirt road at that time, and I was driving down the road behind a small red car with a man in it and someone in the passenger seat. And everything that happened in the essay did happen to me. And I just used it because it was so funny and because it is the writer's life. You do enter into the life around you. You're always watching people. You're always eavesdropping in restaurants. you're always trying to figure out why that person has stopped on the sidewalk and turned towards the shop window but isn't going in. And you know, you're a continual voyeur. And it's funny. It's ridiculous the lengths that you go to try to figure out how people are living around you.
Interesting. Well, that essay was just really remarkable. Again, the twist, everyone, you must pick up that book and read that essay. Your stories are, you deal with relationships, family relationships, in such an interesting way, because it always seems that there's some sort of, something difficult, some darkness, sort of just below the surface, and then it works out again in some sort of uncanny way. In this collection, is there any one story that sort of fits your idea of the perfect short story that you have written, that you just are so glad, so especially glad that it turned out that way?
It's hard for me to answer that. People often say to you, what's your favorite story? And they are written for such different reasons that they don't seem comparable to me. So that, Family Christmas, the first story, is my favorite story about a young girl going to her grandparents' house for Christmas and discovering how complicated her family is and how complicated it is to live in a house with servants and have another family under the same roof. So that's my favorite story about that. But each story is about a completely different set of problems, and each one is working those problems out. So,
what about the facelift? Where did this story come from?
That one, also, that it's a part of that happened to me. I was having lunch with a friend of mine who is Latina, and she told me this amazing story. And I won't give it away, but it's about somebody being hijacked in El Salvador. And it's a story that struck me as being very cinematic. It was something that was so visual to me and so clear in all its details and how it would happen and how the gunman appeared and how he thrust himself into the car, and the women were so frightened, and they were all women, and they were alone. And there was no way really for them to escape what was going to happen to them. And it seemed to me, listening to the story, that it was like a movie that we have all seen. And we can see the face of the young, beautiful woman, and we can see the fear in her face as the gunman grabs her, and we can hear the engines of the car, and your heart just sinks when you see this beginning, and you know what you're going to have to go through, and you know what the pain is that she's going to go through, and the violence and the blood and the guns, and it's just going to be horrible. And then I was so amazed to hear that a different ending had been written, and that it was such an ending that had been clearly written by women. It was women who made this remarkable thing happen. It's not what the men involved wanted to have happen. It's not what the gunman wanted, and it's not the way he would have worked it out, nor is it the way a movie producer would have worked it out. So it was this wonderful shift that I thought was so elegant and so interesting that I wanted to write about how women use different forms of strategies than those of men. And it's also about friendship, and it's also about plastic surgery, and it's also about, I think women's friendship is really interesting. I think it's more complicated and more demanding than men's friendship. Women want more from each other. They're more envious of each other. They're more generous with each other. And because they want more, they often come to grief more often than men do. They often will have fights and not speak to each other, which is not something that men include often in their friendship. So I think it's an interesting subject. Hmm. So all of those things went into that story.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Roxana Robinson, author of A Perfect Stranger and Other Stories. Will you read to us?
Yeah. This is the beginning of a story called Assez, which is the French word for enough. So.
Okay.
That summer, we rented a house in France with friends. It was Stephen who found the real estate agent. She sent us photographs, and Stephen and I spent an evening in Westchester looking at bright, glimmering images of Provence. We sat at the kitchen table, shuffling the pictures back and forth, and finally Stephen slid one over to me. "This looks nice," he said. I held the photograph up. It was a long farmhouse of golden stone with a faded orange tile roof. In front was a flat stretch of pale gravel, shaded by trees. The swimming pool was shimmering turquoise, surrounded by high green hedges. Along the garden paths were cypress trees, cool dark sentinels against a light-filled landscape. I nodded. It looked like paradise. Also, I would have agreed with anything Stephen said then. We were the first to arrive. We took the overnight flight to Nice and then rented a car at the airport. Dizzy with sleep lack and jet lag, we set out across the bottom of Provence to the village of Saint-Emilion, between Aix and Avignon. It was a 3-hour trip on the crowded highway at 80 miles an hour, German cars surging terrifyingly past us, the hot glare of the midi sun in our eyes. When we finally drove into the little stone courtyard of our house, it was early afternoon, and we were dazed with speed and heat and fatigue. Stephen turned off the car, and we sat still for a moment. Everything was silent in the afternoon heat, and the air shimmered. On two sides of the courtyard were the rough stone walls of the rambling house. Beyond the other walls, we could see the narrow, silvery leaves of olive trees. All around us, we heard a weird, high, insect shrill. The front door was unlocked, and we stepped into the cool stone darkness of the hall. The shutters were closed against the sun, and the whitewashed walls were muted and mysterious after the bright light outside. The house was quiet, the air dry and sweet and aromatic. Stephen was beside me, and he leaned over to set down a suitcase. As he straightened, his face moved into a soft shaft of light from a crack in the shutters. Stephen is tall and rangy, with dark hair and eyes and thick, beetling eyebrows. He is an intense man with a dark and forceful manner, and there are times when his darkness and forcefulness are frightening. But just then, the beam illuminated a small, intimate portion of his face, the tender hollow of darkened skin around his eye, damp with the heat. Below the clustered lashes was the liquid brown gleam of the eye itself, innocent and steady. I could smell his skin, the dense, delicious musk my husband gave off when he was tired and sweaty. The sense of his presence, so vivid and so deeply known, gave me a surge of happiness, and I nearly reached out to touch him. "Bonjour!" a woman called from inside the house, and we heard light, clopping footsteps. Madame Garcin, the real estate agent, was in her 50s, with dark, narrow eyes and a thick waist. She wore gold-rimmed glasses, a wrinkled linen dress, and high-heeled mules. "Bonjour, madame," Stephen said carefully in his terrible French. He gave a courteous nod. "Nous sommes les Winstons." I can't speak French. I can read it and understand it, but I can't speak it, and I don't. Stephen can't really speak it either, but he does. He'll say anything. He has no fear. Right then, he was rumpled and travel-stained. A dark beard was starting to thicken on his cheeks, and his sweaty shirt sleeves were rolled up. But still, he looked easy and confident, and I was proud of him for speaking so freely, with that terrible accent, without embarrassment or hesitation. I was proud of him for being so steady and American, for being so sure of himself and of who we were. Nous sommes les Winstons.
Thank you so much. That was Roxana Robinson reading from A Perfect Stranger. Now, where did this story come from?
Well, several things. One is that we used to rent, my husband and I used to rent a house in France in the city, in the town that I, the village that I describe, for over 10 years. And I loved that landscape and I loved being there. And so two of the stories are set in that landscape just because really I loved writing about it. And a critic actually complained and said that in three of the stories I had raised Francophilia to the level of fetishism, which I liked. So it was partly that, and I just love that place. And then what happens at the end in the restaurant is something that did happen to me, and I thought it was a wonderful moment. Very French, very indicative of the difference between French and American responses to things. And I thought it was a remarkable moment that I needed to write about, to present in another context. And then some other things that happened in the story happened to friends of mine. So usually I draw threads from different parts of my experience. As I say, they're not necessary. Some things are completely fabricated, but there's usually something that either happened to me or happened to someone that I know or I was told about. The story at the beach was something that was told to me by a friend.
I wanted to ask you, too, about picking first person or third person. It seems that there might be a few more stories in the book that are written in the first person. And I'm curious as to why you choose each. What makes you want to do a story in first person? What makes you want to do one in third?
I like first person a lot because what I write about is the world of the emotions. It's really important to me to engage the reader, to make the reader feel completely involved in what's happening. And when you write in first person, you can really achieve something that's like pressing your nose up against the window. So you really feel practically there. It just puts you more intimately in connection with the narrator than if it's third person. There's a distance there. And there are obvious benefits. If you're writing in third person, you have access to more information than you do in first person. It has to be constrained to simply the observations and the knowledge of the narrator. But it's something that I think delivers a lot, that I, the sense of I, the sense of being inside that person's sense of brain, consciousness, being inside that person.
Do you ever worry that readers will identify you as the narrator?
I don't worry about it, but it happens constantly. Everyone assumes that the narrator is me, which is one reason I like reading that particular passage, because Madame Garcin is French, and Stephen sounds not French, and I like that sort of play of having her voice, Stephen's voice, and my voice, the narrator, but read in my voice, the writer's. So I just sort of like that, presenting those three voices. But everyone assumes that everything I write, including my family, one of my sisters said, oh, by the way, in your story you said such and such. And I said, actually, I didn't say that. That was the narrator in that story that said that.
And, yeah, it's interesting. I know some writers who write in the first person, and they say, too, that they like to mess with people because they're always assumed to be in their story. So they started just messing with their readers. You know, it's like they're going to think it's us anyway, so we're just going to mess with them. You know, let them really wonder. Anyway, we're coming to the end of our time, and I wonder if you have any advice for the writers who are listening.
Just keep writing, keep writing. Just forget about it if you are not getting the responses you want. And just so many times in the course of my own writing, I have felt that, you know, I wasn't getting response from the world, and it was disheartening. And then I go through the process of remembering why it is that I write. Right, in order to engage with the world, and I write in order to explain things to myself, and that's what gives me the most pleasure. And writing should be done for yourself. And then afterwards, what happens next is another chapter. But the writing itself can be deeply gratifying, and that's what you should keep reminding yourself of.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed
You're welcome.
This.
And continued luck with A Perfect Stranger.
Thanks so much.
That was Roxana Robinson, author of A Perfect Stranger and Other Stories, published by Random House. And she has a website, which is Roxana, with one N, RoxanaRobinson.com. And she was speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Please stay with us. We will be back in just a few minutes with James Fry. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, Rome wasn't built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on the show are not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents, but those of me and my guests and no one else. So we're going to bring on James Fry, and let me say that he's the author of A Million Little Pieces. He's originally from Cleveland and lives in New York City now with his wife and their daughter. And his most recent book, just out, is My Friend Leonard, published by Riverhead Books. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you?
Great, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to be here tonight.
It's great to have you. I'm so interested. I was very aware of your first book that came out, A Million Little Pieces, and now My Friend Leonard. And I am so curious about why you, and, I mean, a lot of writers would put all this into a novel so that they could disguise themselves. And you are so vulnerable and open in these books, and they're considered memoirs. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't ever consider them memoirs or novels or nonfiction books or fiction books or any of it. I just consider them books. They're just stories that I'm telling. They happen to be about my life. And I actually think I'm sort of working in a tradition that's been established long ago by writers like Baudelaire and Celine and Henry Miller, Jack Kerouac, Charles Bukowski. Those guys all essentially did the same thing. Sometimes they changed their names, sometimes they didn't. And sort of what the book's labeled as by the publisher or by the marketing department is sort of irrelevant to me. I mean,
sure,
they are nonfiction books, but as far as me and as far as being vulnerable, that was always sort of the point for me. You know, I saw this thing in France when I lived there about 15 years ago, and it was this crazy skinhead talking about art and his philosophy on art, and he was ranting and raving, and he said, art is not art unless an artist bears one's soul. And I never forgot it, even though the guy who said it was a lunatic. and that has sort of been my goal with the two books, the two very personal books I've written. It was to bear my soul. And they wouldn't have been effective if I hadn't.
Sure. Well, that is such a frustration, I think, for a lot of writers who are writing. You know, they don't want to be considered memoirists, and yet if you look, you know, inside under the copyright information, that's how the books are classified. And you're absolutely right. Kerouac and all those guys were writing what I thought was fiction because I knew nothing about them when I read them.
Right.
And then, of course, later you find out that so much of this was their life. And I like that they used fictional techniques, as you have, where unless you know it's a memoir or unless you know it's based on their life, it isn't. It's a story.
You know, On the Road was actually originally written with all the real names in it and was going to be published as a nonfiction book. But the publisher ran into liability issues. So, you know, 3 months before they published it, they made him come back in and change all the names and they reclassified it. I mean, I think I'm working in a very established tradition, you know, and ultimately people are going to read the books and they're going to either like them or not, regardless of what it says on the cover.
Sure.
You know, we actually had, I believe, in the copyright pages of both my books, had them classified as fiction/literature, not memoir.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. I wanted to talk, though, about just your sort of the visual quality of the words on the page. And I like that you don't indent. And I wonder if you'd talk about some of the visual aspects of your book, of the words on the page here.
I mean, the book looks different than any other books do, simply because I don't ever use paragraph indentations.
Mm-hmm.
When I wrote the first book, that was a big fight I had with Random House when they were going to publish it, because they wanted to add them. And I said, no, it's very deliberately done without them. And they told me that never in the course of their long, illustrious history had they published a book that didn't have paragraph indentations in it. You know, I one of the reasons I do it simply is because I think it looks cool, because it visually is very different, because it visually looks more like poetry than it does prose.
Yes.
Another reason I do it is, which is a much more practical reason, is I think it just makes the book move a lot faster. You know, looking in that, you know, six spaces to the right or however many spaces it is, slows you down.
Mm-hmm.
And if your eye just can move straight down the left side of a page, it's going to move faster.
Mm-hmm. And
there's one other reason I do it,
yeah.
which is sort of because I'm a self-taught writer. You know, I taught myself to write by sitting in a room alone. And when I first started writing in the style I write in, I just didn't know that I was supposed to indent every paragraph.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Well, no quote marks either.
No quote marks. I mean, definitely. I don't use quote marks, again, partially because of speed. You know, I want the books to move very, very quickly. Partially because I was writing movies, and we don't use quote marks for movies. We don't really use dialogue attribution, so I just got used to just popping out the dialogue and then popping out the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is because when I write, I talk everything out to myself, and I try to make the writing resemble spoken communication much more than I worry about having it be written communication.
Yeah.
I think somehow speaking is closer to a more pure form of communication, so I talk everything out. And I know when you and I talk, we don't use quotes, or
right.
We don't attribute what we're going to say to each other. And
sure.
We just say it and it pops out.
Interesting. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with James Fry, author of My Friend Leonard, published by Riverhead Books. As you just said, you were writing screenplays before you were writing books. Well, talk about that. How did that happen? And then how did you go from doing that to books?
Well, I always wanted to write books. When I sort of decided I wanted to try to be a writer, I wanted to write books, but I wanted to teach myself how to write in a way that was unlike anything I'd ever seen and unlike anything that anyone had ever done or was doing, and was also sort of devoid of any influence. As I started trying to figure out how to do that, that's sort of, I think, a very grand idea to try to do. And, you know, when you sit there in front of a blank computer, you're just like, whoa. But I wanted to write, and I wanted to work as a writer, and I wanted to make money as a writer instead of having to support myself with low-paying, menial jobs. So I thought maybe I could just write a movie and sell it. Instead of sort of doing what I think a lot of people do and trying to write, you know, a heartfelt movie or an indie movie or a movie that had a shred of artistic credibility, I just tried to write the most commercial, most sellable thing I possibly could. And I wrote a couple that were really bad, and then I wrote one that I actually thought I might be able to sell, and I moved out to L.A. to give it a crack, and I sort of pulled it off.
And then to books.
Yeah, I mean, not for a long time. I mean, that whole sort of beginning process took place over about a year and a half, from the time I wrote the first bad script to the time I sold one, maybe a little bit longer. Then I kept working in the movies. I wrote other movies. I directed a movie. I produced a couple movies. The whole time I was still trying to figure out how to write books, doing that in my spare time. And then once I sort of found my voice, I quit the movie business, took a second mortgage out of my house, and gave myself a year and a half to write and sell a book.
Interesting. There's a wonderful story, which you're well aware of, perhaps our listeners are not, a cover story with you and the current poets and writers. And in it, you talk about voice, which I think I must have written about in my blog last week or something after I read this, because I was so impressed that, you know, you're talking about voice in a way, you're saying what writers need to hear. Will you talk about voice a bit now in terms of, you know, what you were after in looking for that?
I mean, what I was after is sort of what I said a minute ago, something that was completely unique, something that was unlike anything anybody had seen or done, something that was absolutely recognizable. You know, something that when somebody picked up something I had written, they could read a quarter page of it or less and absolutely know without a shred of doubt that I, James Fry, had written it. I think nowadays, I mean, I think there's MFA programs are great, obviously, but I think a lot of people are taught how to do what is already being done, and they aren't sort of looking forward and trying to figure out how to do things that absolutely aren't being done. You know, I sort of started, when I decided I wanted to be a book writer, I started reading all the sort of great writers of the canon and trying to figure out what similarities they had. And the most obvious similarity that exists between all of them is sort of singular voice. Any writer that's had a huge impact on our culture or our literary culture has always had a very distinct, very defined voice. And so more than anything else, that was the initial goal for me, was to develop some very, very specific, very, very identifiable voice. And I just sat literally for years, and I wrote thousands of just terrible pages trying to figure out how to do it. And I think I did. You know, I'll let the readers and critics be the judge of it, but I personally think I do have a very recognizable, definable, and new voice.
How did you know when you had it? I mean, did you just suddenly feel, okay, I'm finally onto something, or what happened? I mean, especially because it, you know, as you said, it took a long time.
I mean, you're just always trying things, and sometimes things work, and sometimes they don't, and sometimes you put things together and they work, and sometimes they don't. And, you know, I literally just sat down one morning with a big pot of coffee and a cigarette, and I just started writing, and I didn't think about it, I didn't analyze it, I didn't do anything. I just said, I wake to the drone of an airplane engine and the feeling of something warm dripping down my chin. And I have always sort of thought about how I write in a very specific way. I have a very simple formula for it. And I think about a situation and I think, where was I, who was I with, what happened, and how did it make me feel? And the words just sort of came out. I think a lot of it had to do with movie writing, because when you write a movie, you have to be very spare. You have to be very economical. You don't necessarily have to worry about proper punctuation and grammar. A lot of it had to do with sort of that speaking to myself that I was talking about earlier. And part of it had to do with speed. You know, when the voice started to come to me, I was thinking a lot about how society is different now than it used to be. And one way it's very different is the speed with which we live and the speed with which we can literally move and figuratively move. And so I thought that what I did, if I wanted to try to write for the future, speed needed to play a part in my voice. And, you know, literally one morning I just sat down and it came.
And again, this is after years of writing. You know, I think writers, new writers, sometimes want it to come right away. And if it's not there, they feel like failures. You know, they just think, well, I've been writing for a year and it's still not happening the way it should be happening.
I mean, I always tell writers who are new writers, aspiring writers, whatever, I always tell them that if I can do it, anyone can do it. And that was always my attitude, too. I used to think, well, if Henry Miller can do it, I can do it. If Walt Whitman can do it, I can do it. If Celine can do it or Hemingway can do it, then I can do it, too. And the advantage that I think I have over a lot of other people that I know who are smarter than me or more naturally gifted or talented than me or better educated than me is that I can work really hard for really long stretches of time, and I can do it day after day after day after day. And to a certain extent, I really think that's what writing is about, is being able to go back to the desk day after day after day and produce something, even when you don't want to, even when you don't feel like it, even when you have other things you maybe should be doing. Just go back, work. It'll come if you want it to.
Yeah. Will you read to us?
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you just tuned in, you're a little bit late. We have a few minutes left, though, with James Fry, author of My Friend Leonard, published by Riverhead Books. And he's going to read to us.
This is the very beginning of the book. On my first day in jail, a 300-pound man named Porterhouse hit me in the back of the head with a metal tray. I was standing in line for lunch, and I didn't see it coming. I went down, and when I got up, I turned around, and I started throwing punches. I landed two or three before I got hit again, this time in the face. I went down again. I wiped the blood away from my nose and my mouth, and I got up and I started throwing punches again. Porterhouse put me in a headlock, and he started choking me. He leaned towards my ear, and he said, "I'm going to let you go, but if you keep fighting me, I will hurt you. Stay down, and I will leave you alone." He let go of me, and I stayed down. I've been here for 67 days. I live in Men's Module B, which is for violent and felonious offenders. There are 32 cells in my module, 32 inmates. At any given time, there are between 5 and 7 deputies watching us. All of us wear blue and yellow striped jumpsuits and black rubber-soled shoes that do not have laces. When we move between rooms, we walk through barred doors and metal detectors. My cell is 7 feet wide and 10 feet long, and the walls are cement, and the floor is cement, and the bed is cement. The bars are iron, and the toilet steel. The mattress on the bed is thin. The sheets are covered with grit. There is a window in my cell. It is a small window that looks out onto a brick wall. The window is made of bulletproof glass, and there are bars on both sides of it. It affords me the proper amount of state-required sunlight. Sunlight does not help pass time, and the state is not required to provide me anything that helps pass time. My life is routine. I wake up in the early morning. I brush my teeth. I sit on the floor of my cell. I do not go to breakfast. I stare at a gray cement wall. I keep my legs crossed, my back straight, my eyes forward. I take deep breaths in and out, and I try not to move. I sit for as long as I can. I sit until everything hurts. I sit until everything stops hurting. I sit until I lose myself in the gray wall. I sit until my mind becomes as blank as the gray wall. I sit and I stare and I breathe. I sit and I stare. I breathe. I stand in the middle of the afternoon. I use the toilet and I drink a glass of water and I smoke a cigarette. I leave my cell and I walk to the outdoor recreation area. If the weather holds, there are prisoners in the area playing basketball, lifting weights, smoking cigarettes, talking. I do not mingle with them. I do not participate in their approved activities. I walk along the perimeter of the wall until I can feel my legs again. I walk until my eyes and my mind regain some sort of focus until they bring me back to where I am and to what I am, which is an alcoholic and a drug addict and a criminal serving time in a correctional facility. If the weather is bad and the area is empty, I go out despite the weather. I walk along the perimeter until I can feel and I remember. I am what I am. I need to feel and I need to remember.
Thank you so much. That was James Fry reading from The Beginning of My Friend Leonard, published by Riverhead Books. Oh, gosh. So much to talk about. We have about 10 minutes left. Not even 7 minutes. Okay. Talk about selling actually your first book, because I would imagine that's the point at which you got an agent with A Million Little Pieces.
Yeah, I got an agent right before we sold A Million Little Pieces. I mean, you know, like I said, I was a guy who lived in California who taught myself how to write. The way I got an agent was I went to a website. It actually was founded by a guy who went to Irvine. I don't remember what it's called, but it's a website that has a list of writers and who their agents are.
Uh-huh.
And I started looking at writers who I liked and looking at who the agents were that represented them. Once I sort of figured out the two or three agents I thought were people I might fit best with or people who represented the writers I liked the most, I tried to figure out ways to contact them. And I called literally everybody I knew asking, do you know anybody who knows so-and-so? Do you know anybody who works here? Do you know anybody, you know? So I tried to figure out ways to get to the people. Once I did that, I begged them to read it. And once they did read it, I actually was fortunate enough to have my choice between them. And, they sent it out to publishers. We heard 17 no's before we heard a yes. When we did hear a yes, we heard a yes actually from the publisher I would have chosen if I could have chosen anyone. Imprint of Doubleday called Nan Talese.
And, yes.
From there, the book, what happened. We actually spent a year editing the book, and then it came out 6 months later, and it did well.
Interesting. And now My Friend Leonard, same editor?
Well, there was a guy who worked with Nan Talese named
uh-huh.
Sean McDonald.
Uh-huh.
Nan was sort of a supervisory editor, and she would reach each draft and make comments. And then there was another editor who was sort of the day-to-day
mm-hmm.
editor. And he was a guy named Sean McDonald who was younger. He's about my age. And he left Nan. And I have a huge amount of respect for Nan, and I think she's as good at her job as anybody I've ever met, and is, a huge sort of towering figure in literature, in American contemporary literature. But I wanted to go with a guy who I thought I could, spend the rest of my career with. So I went. He went to Riverhead, and I went with him. And it's been cool.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to also ask you about the cover, because I find it so interesting that the cover of My Friend Leonard is pink.
Right.
And, usually pink covers these days are chiclet covers. And I really like that this cover is sort of so much in contrast to the book, to the guts of the book.
I think it is in contrast to the guts of the book, and it isn't. I mean, we made the cover pink for a couple reasons. One was just to sort of counter-program what my image is.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people have this image of me as this sort of snarling, arrogant, tough guy writer. And if that were truly the case, I wouldn't be releasing a book that had a bright pink cover.
Right.
We thought it was cool to sort of give my readership something that they would have never expected. Another reason the book is pink is because it's a book about love. I think A Million Little Pieces is a book about rage. And My Friend Leonard is a book about love, and it's about a bunch of different kinds of love. It's about, romantic love. It's about the loss of love. It's about finding love again. And mostly it's about the love that can exist in a friendship between two people. And pink is the color of love. and we thought it was appropriate. There's sort of another reason why the cover is pink, but I'm not going to talk about that because you need to read the book to understand, but there is another reason it's pink.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's wonderful. And
thank you.
I so love that you do have this singular voice that you've carved out for yourself, and that you did it by writing. There is no other way, of course, but everyone always hopes for the shortcut.
Yeah, I mean, I found no shortcut. It was literally years. It was, you know, I wrote pieces when I was 31 years old, and I started to try to write when I was 25. And those 6 years were, like I said, thousands of pages of just junk.
Hmm. Have you kept anything?
Yeah, I have it all. I have it all. They'll probably publish it when I die and embarrass me, unless I, you know, burn it and erase it all. But it's just junk.
Hmm. Well, it's been wonderful to have you, and I wonder if you have any sort of last words for the writers listening.
Keep it up. I'm as much a reader as I am a writer, and there's nothing better than picking up a book by a new writer and falling in love with it. So keep working, and thank you for all your support, and I look forward to the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was really a tremendous interview, maybe the best I've ever had.
Well, really, how nice.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you, and best of luck, continued luck with you, my friend Leonard.
Thank you very much.
That was James Fry, author of My Friend Leonard, published by Riverhead Books. He was speaking to us from San Francisco, and he is going to be down this way. And let me get my sheet of paper. That just fell, and I had to try to pick it up with my feet, but that didn't work. July 1st, he's going to be at Book Soup at 7:30. Book Soup is on Sunset. I believe Book Soup in Hollywood. You could always Google Book Soup and make sure that's the one, since there's one down here in Orange County too. But 7:30 July 1st. And then on Tuesday, July 5th, he'll be at Vroman's in Pasadena at 7 p.m. Vroman's is a wonderful bookstore in Pasadena, another independent bookstore. And that would be another venue to see him at. There's a parking lot in back, so if you're down this way, you might consider going up to Vroman's Tuesday night at 7. I'm sure it'll be a wonderful, wonderful time. In any case, we are at the end of our time, and if you'd like to know more about the show, you can go to my website, which is penonfire.com. You can read about my book, and you can read about guests who are coming on, guests who've been on, and so much else. So, I'm going to leave you with a quote by Eudora Welty, who said, "Familiarity, memory of the way things get said. Once you have heard certain expressions, sentences, you almost never forget them." Thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and James will be on next with Between the Lines, and I'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
You don't want me, but you don't want nobody else to want me. What kind of man are you? You don't need me, but you don't want nobody else to need me. What kind of thing are you trying to send me through? If you're not gonna take care of